Welcome, everyone. Thank you for tuning in today. And today we have Yugo Kishore is with us, and I have a short bio for Yugo because some of you might not be so familiar with Yugo Kishore, although he is a core member of Tadatmya Sangha. So Yugo Kishore Das has been a bhak on the bhakti path since 2009, when he was a student at the University of Pittsburgh, where he gained a love for Nam Sankirtan, philosophy, theology, and human culture. Since then, he has dived into studying the major world religions to find the common symbolic languages, practices, and unique attitudes toward the holy. He has pursued the liberal arts as a manual for living and has taught math, science, English as a second language in public and private educational programs, high schools, community colleges, and state universities, both in the US and in the Southeast Asia. He now lives with his partner, Kasia, and his cat, Legolas, who you might see on this video, in Norfolk, Virginia, where he serves in the US Navy. He hopes to begin Juris Doctoral studies in 2005 to fight for the rights of marginalized people. He identifies as a follower of Christ and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and aspires to serve the divine couple, Sri Radha Krishna. So thank you very much, Yugo, for joining us and for sharing, being willing to share what you have gathered over the years and part of your journey. I appreciate your courage to step up and to be willing to open your heart and your mind to this process. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Bhakti Ras. You've known me for quite a long time now. My relationship to Tadatmya Sangha is definitely hinges on our relationship to a pretty high degree. And just a reminder to everybody in the Sangha, all I did was ask. I basically approached Bhakti Ras and said, I'm interested in saying something. I don't know what yet, but I am interested in offering something. So here we are. This is what's come out of that. From the flyer, I've paraphrased the theme. So today's theme is fear of loss, and I think we'll hopefully get to the wisdom of acceptance on the path of love or bhakti. So before we begin, I'll say a little Mangalacharam prayer first to the guru. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And to all of you, Pancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Eva Cha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah. If you don't know that last prayer, I'm sure many of you do, but it's a prayer to the Vaishnavs or to the Sangha, to the people in the group, that we wouldn't really be where we are in our own journeys, our spiritual journeys, our faith journeys, without our brothers and sisters right next to us. There's a beautiful symbol of that in the cross, that the cross, of course, goes up vertically, we might say from earth to heaven, but it also goes horizontally, and that's our connection, our lateral connection to each other. So that symbol has been renewed for me somewhat recently. I'll introduce a little bit more about myself biographically. How did I come to Gaudiya Vaishnavism? And of course, well, I consider myself a convert. So that's a big topic. It's a topic that's been on my mind for quite a long time. What does it mean to convert religions, to convert, diets, to convert cultures? Sometimes we talk about multiculturalism. So there's some acceptance that you can be more than one culture. Maybe we'll come to a point where we can accept that people can be of more than one faith too. I don't know if we're quite there yet, but that's where I exist, somewhere in this liminal space of being maybe more than one thing. So the way I experienced conversion in my early days was a very slow but organic process of showing up, asking questions, engaging in dialogue with the monk who I first met. So we can talk about conversion as an inner experience, as a rites of passage, as an initiation. And that this doesn't just happen once and for all. It's not that we do a formal ceremony, though that exists in our tradition and others, a formal initiation ceremony, and that's it. Now I'm done, now I'm converted, thanks be to God. I say the creed and that's it. The faith is now bestowed. Something does happen, of course, during a diksha initiation. Though what exactly it is, nobody can really quite pin down. And I think that's the point. There's something of a mystery happening there. So, for anyone who's listening, I definitely encourage us to continue thinking about this theme of conversion and what that means. Part of my identity, culturally, I'm Western. My mind is Western. I guess you could say my body is Western, my dress anyway. Unless I'm going to some formal setting, you usually won't see me in too much of a Vaishnava decorum. But that's not to say it's not still impressed upon me. But so culturally, I'm Western, and I want to offer up a philosopher's theory on what identity really means. So this philosopher, his name is Dr. Kwame Anthony Appiah. If you've studied some ethics, moral philosophy from the Western tradition, you may have come across Kwame Anthony Appiah. And he has a beautiful lecture series on the BBC from back in 2015-16. The Wraith Lecture Series. It's entitled Mistaken Identities. And in that four-part lecture series, he talks about the four C's that make up identity. The big four he calls color, country, creed, and culture. So we'll dive into those a little bit. Color, I think, is something that's definitely on our minds. It's a prevalent topic throughout most of the world these days. Color, another way to say is race, ethnicity. Country, what is our country of origin? Are we immigrants? Are we not all immigrants? So where do we come from, really? Where's our blood come from? Where does our human family come from? These are really big, important questions to ask. And how we implement that understanding into our self-conception, our own identity. Thirdly, creed. What do we believe? Are we religious in some way? Are we not? Maybe we adopt a scientific creed. Maybe we adopt some sort of moral creed, but it's not necessarily religious. So Yeah, creed could be something, a statement of faith. Sometimes that's very formalized, like in the Catholic tradition, there's you say the Nicene Creed or you say the Apostolic Creed as part of the Mass. I believe in one God, Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. And it continues. And this is their statement of faith. This is their core doctrinal beliefs. So we'll also ask, how does that translate to inner experience? And then lastly, culture. Culture is huge. Culture is a multi-pronged aspect of our identity because it involves so much. I talked about, the way we dress, what we eat, how we think of the body, how we think of relationships. Bhakti Ras, we talked a little a couple days ago just to prepare for this, and gender. We talked about how gender may fall under the heading of culture. So by creed, I would say I'm something of a Hindu in the broad sense. This is how I explain myself to others who don't know what Gaudiya Vaishnavism is, or maybe don't know Indian philosophy and religions very much, but Hindu in the broad sense of, including various practices. That was one of the most attractive things to me as I was learning at first, that Hinduism seems to be able to include, to pull in, and to validate so many different practices and belief systems. Of course, we have the Sat Darshanas, the six different schools of classical Indian philosophy. But then we also have, bhakti cults. Three major bhakti cults. This is nothing new if you've, if you're on the path, but the tapestry of Indian religion is huge, and inclusive, and that's the maybe the stance that I would like to try to take. So partly today, I want to base some of our ways of talking about spirituality and identity and our journey. Of course, the themes of loss and uncertainty and death will come up as part of the journey. And I want to base this off of Richard Rohr's five touchstones of spirituality and try to pull some analogs to the Gaudiya Vedanta. What are sort of analogous concepts that we might have within the Vedantic systems and then Gaudiya Vaishnavism specifically? So the first one that he mentions is nature, that nature itself is a touchstone of spirituality. I like the term touchstone. I think it's kind of, I don't know, it's new. We don't hear that a lot, at least from Gaudiya's. And it reminds me very much of the Lord of the Rings, the Palantiri. You can see through the stone, the wizard's stone. So I like that word a lot. But anyway, nature is that first one. And in the Gaudiya canon, we consider Mother Nature really the one of the main one of the first goddesses, Go Mata, Mother Earth, Bhumi Devi, the cow being a symbolic representation of Mother Earth in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. The earth takes on the form of the cow to go plead her case to Vishnu of, please help me. These humans are terrorizing me. I'm suffering, I'm struggling. And this is very pertinent to today. The fact that we can lean into this mythical conception of, the earth as a person, I'll say mythical because these are stories that have big symbols. And I'll talk about myth a little later on too. But we see this today, the growing, the pangs of the earth. Natural disasters, are getting so much worse. And if it's not, there's no coincidence that nature is the first touchstone. If we can't see our intimate, inextricable connection to the earth, then we're probably not going to go very far on any path. There was a very beautiful short little video interview that Swami Padmanabha shared with our group recently. It was of Richard Rohr, kind of a compilation, 15-minute video, and he was being asked kind of about his own conversion experience. The question was posed, when did you first feel, I'm paraphrasing, but when did you first feel, intimately connected to God, this sense of unconditional acceptance or love? And he told his story, and he used this term. He said that he had this experience when he was 19 years old. He was laying under the stars out in the country in the middle, in mid-America. This is the 50s before there's so much light pollution. So again, he's in nature, contacting nature, and he felt two things. He felt, I am beloved, I'm a beloved, and I'm a son of the earth. And you could put those two things together. I'm a beloved son of the earth. I'm a beloved daughter of the earth. I'm a beloved child of the earth. Yes. We must find that in ourselves. We're born from this earth. The second touchstone is image. And I think he just really nails it here. He gives really good, wide, thematic ways of connecting. So image, we could relate to imago Dei, being made in the image of God. We find that in Genesis 2. Also, the way I think about image is, iconography, both sacred art and secular art, that through art itself, art is a reflection of nature. I think any Art 101 class in college will teach you, we're trying to basically reflect our attitudes towards nature through art. And in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, we have very similar iconography, or what we call murti, the statue, the image form of God. This is something very beautiful about our tradition, that we say God is so compassionate, so merciful, that they will descend into the form of the deity and allow themselves to be worshipped that way, seen that way. So the concept of darshana, that we are seeing the God by going in front of it, but the God is also seeing us. And yes, art is such a beautiful way to be able to reconnect with essence. Also, it's said somewhere, if someone has an exact scriptural quotation, please feel free to add it later in the chat or on YouTube or whatever. But I believe it is said somewhere, probably, I won't even try to guess, but that the murti, the statue image of God, should be made out of something natural. Wood, marble, stone, mud, jewels. All these elements of nature we're gathering, and we're assembling an image from nature. And then, of course, during arati, our high ceremonies of worship, this very formal ceremony of worship in Vaishnavism, we're offering back what? Again, on the plate, on the tray, we have water, flowers, incense, natural aromas, natural earth, all these natural elements we're offering back. So image to me is very much a reflection of nature. And we do have a few people on right now, so I would love to encourage anyone to raise their hand. Bhakti Rasa is moderating. And if you have a burning question, feel free. This, we want to be move these Tadatmya talks to being more conversational and less presentational. So feel free to hop in at any time, but I'll continue on here. So the third touchstone that Richard Rohr offers is story. And I'm so excited about that. I'm a huge Tolkien nerd. Tolkien was a philologist, meaning that he studied words. It's an uncommon word. We don't hear philology that much anymore, but a lover of words, a lover, philos, of logos, a lover of logos, a lover of words. So he studied, he was a Oxford professor, and he wrote about story. And not only did he write about story, he wrote stories. Of course, we know him for Lord of the Rings, in Middle Earth, and all of his own created mythology. So when I think of story, how do we connect to each other and through the to the divine through story? Well, the two things that come up for me are Leela and liturgy. I don't think they're, I think it's probably not a coincidence that they both are L words. So liturgy literally means the words that are used during Mass. For example, when the high mass in the Catholic or Lutheran or Anglican church, anything that was based off of the old structured Latin mass, it was supposed to be reenacting a reenactment of parts of the life of Christ. One, the highest reenactment in the Mass is the Last Supper, reenacting the Last Supper, breaking of bread, pouring of wine, and the liturgy is the very specific words that are used there to describe symbolically what is happening here. So, of course, in story, in mythos, in myth, there are symbols that are infused with meaning that are more than just what they appear on the surface. So when I use the term mythos, I mean, and I'll quote Swami and Richard Rohr on this, and my old professor, Dr. Charles Don Keyes. He said, myth is what is always true. Myth means what is universally true, because the symbols are so infused, they can apply across the board. It's not time, place, circumstance specific. Myth is bigger than that. And in Western philosophy, for Plato, for Aristotle, for the pre-Socratics even, they separated myth and logos somewhat, mythos and logos. That logos took on the idea of logic, right? Of analytical thinking, of breaking things down into their smallest parts. Whereas mythos was that kind of big binding web of story that tied it all together. So one of Plato's projects anyway was to, in some sense, correct change and correct our attitudes towards the gods. The ancient Greek myths talked about gods that were not the perfect good beings that we think of maybe today. Maybe we still retain some fear of the gods because of that past. But there's stories of infanticide. There's stories of rape. There's stories of all sorts of incest and interfamilial problems and abuses and everything within the high myth. So Plato took it on himself to say, no. What are we teaching our children? Why are we teaching them that the gods are like this? And we need to course correct. We need to reframe that. So he used philosophy to try to, in a sense, prove that the God is good. And conversely, that the good, whatever we acknowledge as good in this world, is the God. So that's a beautiful project of his. I also say here that story is a bridge between man and man. Of course, when I say man, I mean humanity, I mean people. Please forgive my somewhat old, archaic training and talking about this, but I take this from a basic literature class, right? That there's in any story, there's conflict. Without conflict, there's no story. So how we talk about these conflicts are, man versus man versus nature, man versus himself, some psychological inner conflict. I think I'm maybe missing one, but anyway, you get the point. And in telling these stories, we are, when we pass down story from generation to generation, of course, everything was first oral transmission. And by hearing the story, we're told that in bhakti, on the path of devotion, what is first? What are the first aspects of that path, the practices of devotion? Shravanam, kirtanam, smaranam. Shravanam is listening. So first we're hearing something new, we're hearing the story. Kirtanam, we're now kirta, we're now pronouncing something, we're now adding to the story in some way. And smaranam basically is memory or remembering. Without story, we wouldn't be able to pass down our cultural heritage. Tradition moves through the collective memory. There's so much more that could be said about all of these things. So this is really just my own way of interpreting Richard Rohr's model for spirituality, and then finding parallels that we have, that I have in my Christian belief in exposure and practice, and also in my Vedic equivalent. The fourth touchstone that Richard Rohr mentions is ritual. And I think our groups have been talking about ritual a little bit recently. We can understand ritual to be something, very high, very formal, maybe even empty, because it's too formalized, and there's some disconnect between what we want to happen and what appears again to be happening on the surface. So ritual, the word ritual can be connected to a writ, a rite of passage. I like to connect that to, and of course the others have done this too, so I'm probably not saying anything new here, but the sacraments in the church, the high sacraments, those are rites of passage. Marriage is a rite of passage. Your identity is drastically changed when you decide to join in union with another person. That's a rite of passage. Taking monastic vows is a rite of passage. Yes, Bhakti Rasa.
Yeah, so it's interesting what you just said. Just trying to get an idea of what rites of passage is. So you said getting married is a change of identity. So it seems like rites of passage that's the demarcation of a change of our identity. And then the rite of passage is what marks that.
Yeah. I think I understand what you're saying. Rite of passage, passing from where to where. So it's some transition that's happening, both outwardly maybe, and that's where ritual can take on so much outward form, but also inwardly. So we can dive into that right now, actually. I mean, I have an outline here, but it does come back up again later. Father Rohr says that, ritual begins by, I have my yoga teacher friend here, and every one of her classes, she starts in saying, let's set our intention. Intentionality is what makes ritual, it is what bridges the gap between the external performance and what's happening inside. Setting a sankalpa, an intention, right? That's the essence. So you could have a ritual, you could do a ritual by yourself. In fact, many of us do that. We worship our deities at home, but probably by ourselves. Maybe we have a partner there with us. what's happening? You know, am I just, you know, paying a toll to the god so that I earn something in return? Or am I making something more? What am I really asking for through this ritual? That's how you answer that question, by setting your intention. Of course, on the bhakti path, which will be a little bit different than jnana, you know, the path of knowledge, on the bhakti path, we're really offering ourselves, we're offering our hearts, we're offering our wholeness to the divine, allowing ourselves to be seen. So, yes, there's these material elements on the tray, but none of that matters other than what is in your heart when you're doing this performance. That is what is seen. And there is a quotation from the Gita that says, that verifies that statement. I'm sure one of you could quote it, but don't ask me to do that. Yeah, I have another example here of, and this was something that's really sweet and pertinent, I think, name giving. You know, in ancient Vedic society, name giving was a ceremony. It was its own rite of passage, that when a child was born, they weren't pre-planned with a name. The gender reveal happened at the moment of birth. We didn't have medical technology to do all that other stuff. And then usually some weeks would go by before the child's personality evoked, called forth a name. And then that name was given. And it was generally not even given by the parents, it was given by an astrologer, a seer. I can tell you that I had lived in Southeast Asia for 4 years, from end of 2014 up until mid 2018. And my partner out there, partner in crime, she was from Myanmar, from Burma, and born in a little village in the south. She was given her name by a village astrologer. So these practices are marginal, maybe culturally speaking. Western societies don't think this way. It's probably becoming less prevalent in Asian societies as well. What to speak of, I can't speak for African societies or others, but it still exists, this idea that the name is something that, in a way, you already have. It's just a matter of finding it. It's a matter of bringing it out to the surface. I think that's important to me, because I question myself sometimes. You know, should I call myself Yugala Kishore Das? Should I just stick with my birth name, John Michael Stuparitz? You know, who am I really? The name is kind of at the heart of that. And of course, there's our wisdom teaching that says Krishna is non-different from his name, from his form, from his pastimes, from his paraphernalia. All of the things that Krishna employs, and even just his name, are identical with his essence. So that is the backbone, that is the theoretical basis, anyway, for how chanting the names through kirtan, through japa meditation, that's really the basis for that practice. That's where Nam Tattva comes from, as our main practice, saying, calling on the names. Hinduism is beautiful here, because Hinduism, of course, has so many names. There's the thousand names of Vishnu. There's the thousand names of the goddess. There's so many other personal names that come from the Puranas for the different avatars, the different incarnations of the divine. And yet we should find some universality there too, because I do hear in Christian liturgy your holy name, calling on your holy name. I hear this also in the Muslim tradition and in the Jewish tradition, calling on the holy name. So there's something there. It's maybe I call it a marginal practice because it's not what you see if you enter into a space like that. It's not what you're going to see first. But there is a marginal practice of passing down the name. So that brings us to the
I have a
fifth.
question. I have a
Yes,
question. You were
please.
saying a marginal practice when passing down the name. You mean you're talking about our names or names of God?
Well, and so good question. So in a formal diksha initiation ceremony, a mantra is given from the teacher to the student. And that mantra incorporates the names of the divine in some way. Now, I don't know all that much about Gayatri mantra. I was given Harinam mantra, so the three names of Krishna, Hara, Krishna, Rama. And yes, that a marginal practice. I'll build on that maybe a little bit later. So
Okay.
allow me to stipulate that term for now, and we'll talk more about that another time. But basically, that this is not popular culture. Let's just say it that way. The importance of name generally doesn't take on that much in terms of popular culture, at least in our conscious awareness of it. Now, of course, names can invoke a lot of feelings. So we might not know, but just saying the name of, someone who we don't like can be a really, really powerful, trigger. So names have a lot of energy in them.
Yeah, and I was just thinking also, like in prior times too, like in royal families, or they would give a name that would evoke a certain quality of that person, and you kind of grow into your name, right?
Yes.
Because the sound creates form. That's where form comes from. So by identifying with particular qualities and the sound of the name, then we kind of grow into that form, into our name. Like, did you ever notice sometimes people look like their names?
Yes.
It's like, so it's interesting.
Yes, and I don't think that, again, I mean, those aren't coincidences. There's a practice at least through the English speaking world of kind of dubbing someone a name. Like, how do we have the name Baker? It's an occupational name. That family were bakers at one time. Smith or Smithies. There's occupational names, there's place names. Davia from Avia, Saint Francis d'Assisi from Assisi, right? Thomas Aquinas, his name was not Aquinas. His name was just Thomas. That was his surname. Aquinas was where he was from. So
And
there's,
it's like that
yeah.
with Krishna also. Krishna's names are based on his qualities or his relationships or his pastimes,
Yes,
things
we
that he's done,
yes.
ways that he is, things that he's done, people who he's related to. So
Sometimes
we
I
have
like,
this
yeah.
pattern.
Sometimes I like to think that a proper name, in English grammar, we would capitalize any proper noun, and that a proper name is actually the core of all language. There is no thing in itself other than a name, right? Like table as table, in a sense, it's a proper name because it hits the essence of what that thing is. And I really do believe, maybe I don't want to stray too far into my own semantics and stuff, but that yes, at one time everything was a proper name. And let's maybe use that as a lead into everything can be essential, everything can be sacred, and ultimately is. It just depends on how we use it, how we see it. I'll mention quickly the last of the five touchstones, which Richard Rohr calls the way of counsel, or simply counsel. And let me refer you to the website, illumin.org. I don't know, Bhaktiras, if you maybe could put that in the chat, illumin.org. That website is the organization that facilitates counsel throughout mostly America, but also now Europe, Australia, and other places. Let me correct that for you, real quick. ILLUMAN.org.
Yeah, it auto-corrected.
Okay, no worries, no worries. Just so you know, if you do visit that website, that group is oriented towards male spirituality. So I don't want to, send you there and then, oh no, this isn't for me. There's so much there that I believe it can broadly apply. In fact, I asked that question a few weeks ago when I went to my first ever Illumin retreat. What about women? Are they not el can they not do these same things? And yes, of course they can. It's just that Richard Rohr had recognized a serious need in our current time for men to have their own spaces, their own safe spaces. Let me justify that a little bit. Cult society nowadays generally doesn't grant men the ability to show their emotions in public, other than maybe anger. You can have anger, but do not dare show sadness, do not dare show fear, right? So in Richard Rohr starting an organization like this, it's to redeem, it's to bring back the whole spectrum of emotionality for men. And similarly, I can't wait for an empowered woman to do that formally, maybe through an organization for women. I heard, and I'll mention this now because it was so important to me when I heard this. This probably could become an entire episode unto itself, but Richard Rohr had recorded, he wasn't able to make it to the retreat this year because of his health, but he had pre-recorded a little interview. And he ended up saying in that interview that the difference in the trajectory of a biological man's life, a biological woman's life, is somehow that because women are thrown into a rite of passage through their menstrual cycle, through their hitting puberty, usually earlier, sometimes a lot earlier than boys, they're thrown into a rite of passage. That is what makes now them a woman in some sense. Just in the sense of, the ability to procreate. Of course, I want to dive more into those gender typical stereotypes that we use around what is a man, what is a woman. Some of that needs to be torn down, some of that needs to be rebuilt or preserved. But he ended up saying that the difference in the trajectory of the life of a man and woman is that a man is told to be angry first. And then later, if he is able to get to the second half of life, now he has re is able to redeem his fear, his sadness. And that a woman is opposite in so many ways. A woman is expected to be afraid, sad, whatever, for the first part of life. Many of us get stuck in our first part of life. But actually, when a woman hits her second part of life, now it's because she's been given her anger back. And I think we would do well by our partners to allow them to have their anger, to honor that. I've had my half of life where I've been angry. Now it's the other person's turn. He bases some of this off of off of the Old Testament prophets, that the prophetic voice a lot of the time was an angry voice. It was calling out righteous, using righteous anger to call out injustice in the world. There is a place for anger. In fact, if you go back to the summer, we had some beautiful offerings by our by two women, at least three women actually, who have been doing great work in terms of digging into the emotions, making space for anger, distinguishing anger and sadness. So much of male anger is actually sadness that we haven't permitted ourselves to express. So, a little bit more about counsel. What is counsel? Counsel is a format of bringing people together in dialogue. And it's easiest to talk about what counsel is by saying some things that it is not. So it's not group therapy. It's not worship. It's not, an expression of faith. It's not a club. It's not a reading group. It's none of those things. It is essentially a circle of people who have come to share wisdom with each other, and in doing that, trying to bring down or trying to evoke the mystery, the spirit that exists somewhere between or somewhere above and beyond just the individuals in the group. You might say that counsel and satsang potentially are the same thing. I love that in our group, now in our Sangha, we're moving away from this lecture style, guru on the Vyasa Sun speaking for 5 hours, everyone else sleeping in the back. Or maybe if you're a very good boy or girl, you're up front, hanging on every word. But how much are we able to change our hearts if we're not given the chance to actually engage with that? And how much more wisdom could come? There's so much failure in that model of transmitting knowledge from one source of knowledge outward. There's so much lost in denying that a lot of knowledge is actually dialogical, Socratic, dialectical, that it's something that's produced through engaging with each other. I said just the other day on our Q&E, what was it? I kind of lost my thought. But anyway, dialectical, that, yes, this is what it was, that, our own truth. We have to be able to express our own truth to understand what is truth. And you can only do that through conversation and dialogue. Okay. So I think I'll leave counsel there. You have the website if you want to see more about that, what that is. But we're also trying to do that within our Sangha, having safe gendered spaces where if you identify as a male, you're welcome into our brotherhood sanctuary. If you identify as a female, you're welcome into sisterhood sanctuaries. So let me speak a little bit, I guess, connect some of these five touchstones to my story of how I came to Krishna consciousness. We won't go maybe as in depth as we did one-on-one Bhakti Rasa, because I do intend to, I think, end this around 11 o'clock. So we still have a good amount of time. But yes, all the way back in 2008, I was in my second year at University of Pittsburgh. And I want to talk about, fear, uncertainty, loss, and death, how that relates to my own story. So right before I had met Chaitanya Das, I had some loss in my life. I lost a relationship that crushed me, completely heartbroken. Right at the same time, I had gotten mononucleosis virus that just zapped my energy for about a month. So I was really questioning. I had already completed my first year in college, so I had that rite of passage moving from standard high school, now the freedom of the university. Hopefully that's what a university is supposed to be, a universe of all different knowledge. Everything was generally speaking, I was doing fine in school, but I felt like something was missing, something was empty. Disclosure, I had been seeing a psychologist for a couple of years before that, trying to understand, why is my family the way it is? Why am I the way I am? Why, how unfair it is that my brother has this mental health problem. And all these questions, all this uncertainty was in the background that then led me to my first ever yoga class. So I will always praise my sister Carrie, because she had first met Chaitanya Das. He had given her a Gita. She was very open and was like, okay, this is cool. I think she was also at a similar place in her life. We're kind of Irish twins. She's about, 16 or 18 months older than me. And she invited me. She recognized, like, John, something's off, something, you're struggling a little bit. Come to this yoga class with me. So that first yoga class in the fall of 2008, I dragged two of my guy friends with me because I was, nervous that I'm a man. I can't go to a yoga class. That's like stretching and Pilates and, wearing tights and stuff. So I dragged two of my guy friends, two of my drummer friends with me. One happened to be Indian, and we did the yoga. We all enjoyed it a lot. And then right after the hatha yoga practice, or it was a vinyasa flow class, right after that ended, in walked a man wearing orange robes, head shaved, a little tuft of hair in the back, and with this drum. And we were all drummers. So I was like, okay, I don't know what's about to happen, but I'm interested. And he explained what mantra meditation is, and he handed out mantra sheets. And we ended up chanting Hare Krishna for the next 45 minutes. And I remember distinctly dancing, just dancing in complete joy, really losing myself in that. And I had never found anything. I've never dreamed that I even would need something like that, but wow, the liberation of dancing and chanting and really getting tribal, really getting sort of primal in our expressions. So, all glories to Chaitanya Das for making those beautiful offerings to our group. So, one question I might ask myself is not just like how did the conversion start, but also what had to give? What did I have to give up to stay on the train, to continue learning? So many of us devotees will say, prasadam, this nice, beautiful, lovely vegetarian food hooks us, or kirtan, dancing and chanting and singing, hooks us. I think a lot of us get hooked by the philosophy, that there's this really strong, this ancient wisdom tradition that we probably didn't know about before if we are converts. I'll reflect back to my friend Samir, the Indian guy I brought with me. He ended up saying, John, you just took me to Sunday school. What the heck? Because he grew up with, he grew up in an Indian Hindu household. So he was like, not exactly what I thought we were going to be doing, but okay, whatever. And yeah, over the course of that semester, I just started to devote more of my time and my energy and my care into learning about this new tradition. I came across, of course, very early on, the four regulative principles of Srila Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And they seemed like good challenges, at the time for me. I was 19 years old, and I'm like, huh, I could, not using intoxicants. That's like very out of touch with everybody else in college. Let me try that. So that was inspiring to me at first. Giving up meat eating. Again, that was the first one I took on because it was, I felt like it was doable in some way. Other people are surviving without meat. Let me see how it works for me. Will I survive without it? And I ended up surviving. Excuse me for a second. And of course, we already know all four regulative principles. Some of them may have been more challenging than others. It depends on the person. It depends on, your upbringing. So many different impressions and things. But some of them were harder for me than others. I won't try to break them all down, but I am so appreciative now of being taught and coming to realize that it's not sanctions do not do. It's more point the do not is pointing us to the positive characteristic that we're trying to build in ourselves. Purity, honesty, sobriety, that is clear thinking, clear feeling, compassion for all life. No, I wasn't a very sentimental teenager. I didn't think bunnies and bunnies and birdies or something, but I really actually just accepted the authority. I said, well, there's some knowledge, there's some real source of authority here, because other people are changing their lives for this, at least this one monk. So I guess I could say it was really from a religious place that I adopted that, and then started to accept, nonviolence as the underlying principle, and compassion as the positive corollary to nonviolence. I want to offer the concept up, which is used in some Zen Buddhist circles, about beginner's mind. So, in trying to understand for ourselves how our conversion processes have worked, how these transitions have brought us from one place in our life, into a new identity, into another new identity, that having a beginner's mindset, being open to receiving and being open to giving. Swami Padmanabha has said this perfectly for all of us, that vulnerability is where it begins. We have to be willing to fail. We have to be willing to be wrong. We have to be willing to lose, to not know, to, it might sound strong, but just to connect it to my theme, to die. We have to be willing to die. Willing to die to what is no longer serving us. Willing to die to those conceptions and those life stories that we had told ourselves that were delimiting. And then if we are able to walk across that bridge, naturally, I think we renew our story. We start to see how those failures have led into greater successes. So in the beginning, yes, Bhakti Rasa, please.
Hey, it just came up. It seems like when we have organized kind of rites of passage, well, when we don't have those, then the thing that makes us move forward, move towards those positive things, we need a disaster first in our life
Yes.
that shakes things up, that makes what we're leaving behind like nothing. It
Yes.
was our life, but now it's in rubble. So now we are free to move forward. Whereas if we have like organized societal rites of passage, then those disasters might actually not need to take place because it's more of a voluntary thing. So if we don't engage in these rites of passage voluntarily, then they might come to us from the other side.
Yes, absolutely. Life is going to force you into passages, into transitions, whether you want it or not, whether we've created some systematic approach to that or not. The body throws you into things. I mean, the what are the in the life of the Buddha, the four things he saw that told him something's wrong was sickness, old age, disease, and death. And then I think the fifth, or maybe I was a little bit off with those, but And then he saw a monk. What is that? Why, what the heck is that? You know, first it was the crisis of like, oh no, you know, life isn't perfect. People have pain and suffering. And am I acknowledging my own? And then the image of the monk for him anyway. And I think for myself, if I can say, you know, meeting Chaitanya Das was like, there's a different way. There's another way of approaching life through self-discipline. At least when you take monastic vows, there's this expectation of some self-discipline. Literally, sva me, meaning sva is self, is a reflective pronoun, the self. Svami meaning self-controlled, one who's able to actually be in control of themselves. Yes, this is very, very important. Even our education, in a way, is our rites of passages built into Varnashram Dharm system, our rites of passages from Brahmacharya to Grihastha or not, to Vanaprastha to Sannyas, you know. And not all of them are necessary for everybody. I do like that they will come when the person needs them. I think they will, the teacher presents themselves when the student is ready. So a really healthy frame of mind to stay in is beginner's mind, that whatever I think I know, let me say that I don't actually know. Another way to put that, this again, I take from my philosophy professor, Charles Don Keyes, and he said, whether you're atheist or you're theist, to be human, really, to be truthful, to be honest, means that you have to admit you're agnostic to some degree. Agnostic, you don't actually know everything. So every bit of every theistic position has a whole shadow side of agnosticism to it. Every atheistic position has a whole shadow side of agnosticism to it, that I don't know everything. In fact, that's not the journey. Yeah. Okay. So yes, I love that you mentioned, you know, disasters, and this is actually a reflection question I want to ask to everybody. What things were at stake when you were in your moment of crisis? What things were at stake? What things were possibly going to be lost? I'm sure for so many people, there was friendships that could have been lost. There was family maybe that you were tempted to leave or abandon. There was work. There was maybe your previous faith. Maybe there was some health concern, or, you know, I know personally on my journey, I've struggled with my mental health at times, and I've come to places where I thought I was losing my sanity. You know, there was too many opposing notions in my head that I really thought I was losing it. And ultimately your identity, you know, losing oneself, losing your identity might be the biggest fear for many of us. So let me fast forward just a little bit. In 2011, that's whenever a big change happened for me. This was a serious crisis of faith that I had. After building myself and learning something for 3 or 4 years, in 2011, I was basically felt that I had this ultimatum put in front of me. Either this or that. Either you're a brahmachari, either you're a gaudiya, or you're a karmi, you're a mayavadi, you're not part of our group. You're either in the group or you're out of the group. And based off of a ethic of self-preservation, I said, well, okay, so I'm not in the group then. And this, you know, Swami says this so nicely in terms of fitting in versus belonging. The path of love is one of belonging. and inclusion. It's not about breaking down your character to build you back up. That's something they say in the military. They say that in other settings. I say no to that. The breakdown maybe is internal, but it should never be coerced. It should never be forced. If someone is pushing you that way, I would really call into question their intentions. And let me direct a quote, or direct us to a quote from Radical Personalism, Swami's last book, page 97. He uses the term svajatiya prasang. Svajatiya prasanga, a deep connection with like-minded individuals. This is kind of like the heart of satsanga. We want belonging, we want to feel understood, and beyond understanding, we want unconditional acceptance and love. That's something that's very beautiful. It's very core principle of counsel, the way of counsel. You do not have to understand everyone. You just have to accept them. Now, what that looks like will be different in various situations. Sometimes acceptance can look like rejection, maybe, I don't know. But the point is that it's not about understanding everything everyone says. It's about allowing them to say it. It's about holding space for them to be able to say what they need to say, to express their truth. Swami said recently, something like this: a Vaishnava is someone who can hold on to a lot of pain, can be a container for others' pain. So that's just a really beautiful way of framing that. I have another reflection question for everybody. So, what fears come up for you when confronted by the choice of fitting in or individuating, becoming yourself? What fears come up for you when you're pressed by that choice? Do I stifle my truth to appear the same as everybody? Or is it through deep sharing of our truths that we come to accept and we come to like each other's minds? I love words also, just like Swami. So, having a community is a common unity, having a common place of unity. And one of the sacraments in the Catholic Church is communion. Communion is another name for the sacrament of the Eucharist. The Eucharist is the bread, essentially, the body of Christ. And in that liturgy, I'd mentioned this a little bit earlier. This word Eucharist is Greek. You can look this up. This isn't deep scholarly work or anything. This is easy to access, but Eucharist actually literally means thanksgiving in Greek. So the liturgy is that Christ took the bread, gave thanks, and broke it, saying, "This is my body given for you." Right? So that moment of giving thanks, that is the heart of the ritual. That's the intention made plain. And of course, Bhakti Rasa, we mentioned, our corollaries in Gaudiya Vaishnav ritual tradition, that somehow with some magic fairy dust, we hope and pray that bhoga is turned into prasadam. We hope that gathering of these natural elements, the cooking of the food, by bringing our heart and our intention with it, this food has now turned into the mercy, God's mercy. Literally, prasadam is God's mercy. So, we still have a little bit of time. I think I can get maybe to the end of my outline here. I'll jump forward just a little bit more, and I want you guys to know that for me, partly in presenting anything to you is presenting myself. So this autobiographical strand is how I hope to open up the concepts of, you know, the place of fear, loss, uncertainty, and death on our journey. So in 2014, I ended up taking formal Diksha. That was the name Yugal Kishore Das was given to me. Mantra beads and the Krishna, Krishna Nam was given to me. And this is a prevalent topic for conversation today, because we know that our specific tradition, our teachers, our last so many generations of teachers, how do we link ourselves back to that source, right? So partly this might be through some sort of formal entrance, some sort of formal conversion, right? And some traditions, it's like, no, you actually do have to do a formal conversion. You can't marry my daughter unless you're whatever, Jewish or Catholic. So, okay, go be, you know, do the right thing and go say your creed and, you know, bow in front of the priest, and then now you're okay. Now you're allowed in. Or is it Diksha, or is it Shiksha, or is it something, is it both? Is it something in between? Shiksha meaning simply teaching. I don't know the etymology of that word. Please add comments if you want to break down that word more. But Shiksha, the way I understand, is just going to the person through desire for learning, versus Diksha, the formal ritual of being initiated. There's a almost exact corollary of this this debate, if we can call it a debate, in the Christian church. One of the biggest splits of the church happened in, I won't try to say the year, but Martin Luther breaking away from the Catholic Church and creating what is now Protestantism. You know, a protest. He was protesting with his, how many theses, 97 theses or something like that, nailed to the door. And the big theological question became, is it salvation through works? Are we saved because of what we do? Or is it salvation through grace? Are we saved simply because God is that magnanimous? We don't ever really do anything to deserve transcendence. We are all, you know, there's so many ways we can talk about this, but that comes up in the church too. How, you know, what does sadhana look like? What do our practices look like? What are we expected to do in the world if we have this understanding that we are, you know, we are saved, or we are a beloved son or daughter of the earth? So those questions were very much on my mind when I took Diksha. It wasn't like some sort of, you know, it didn't feel like a birthday. It didn't feel like a jubilation of any sort. It felt heavy for me. It felt like I don't even quite know what I've done. And I walked away from that experience feeling like I need to go now out into the forest. I'll borrow that concept from our last discussion. You know, on the hero's journey, leaving home, leaving the warmth of the fire, and then trying now to go figure out what it is I need for myself, for my life. So what that looked like for me was leaving the country. I had left the US and moved to very far away. Myanmar, Burma. I lived in Myanmar for about 3.5 years, and sometime in Thailand as well. And that was hard. There was so much uncertainty. Who am I? There was a huge amount of culture shock. There was also a lot of clarity. I felt for the first time in years that I was happy. I was happy. I was excited about life again. So sometimes losing something is what enables us to open ourselves up to finding something new. And I definitely realized in that experience of, you know, having zero contacts on the ground there, moving to a new country, new language, new religion, even, you know, it's somewhat similar to India culturally, but it's a Buddhist country. 70% are Buddhist. I had some Hindu friends there that I met, but we were a minority. And yet there were shared cultural practices of meditation and dress, and you know, vegetarianism wasn't terribly difficult there, but it certainly was not Whole Foods. So that's where a lot of conceptions that I had from early on really started to change. What is the value of vegetarianism in places where it's just not feasible? You know, what is the ethic then? What is the compassion then? If people don't have access to clean, easily vegetable, fruit, food sources. So I think,
Hugo,
yes.
hey, I have a question.
Sure.
I'm missing the piece. Was there something that happened prior to you moving to Myanmar, where you said it was difficult when you took initiation and
Yeah.
you got your name and were trying to really, you were taking that seriously. But what was there something involved with that had you then reach out and redefine yourself and find yourself again?
I knew I had to leave Pittsburgh. I'm from born and raised in Pittsburgh. I met devotees in Pittsburgh. I did my education in Pittsburgh. So I knew I had to leave. My circle was getting really small. I knew I couldn't be all I could be by staying there at that time. I knew I had to leave. And if there was negative impetus too, because my old high school circle, you know, drugs were becoming a really bad problem. That was really the beginning of the opioid epidemic in America. And I lost quite a few friends to drug overdose. And I felt that if I stayed, I didn't have the empowerment at that point in my life, to be able to save myself and to be able to help them in a way I really wanted to. So it was a really tough choice of saying the best way I can help anybody is first to get myself properly situated. That
Thank you
took
for sharing that.
years. Yes. Thank you for asking. Thank you for asking. So that didn't last forever. I knew I had to return. And in 2018, I did decide to return to the US. That was its own confrontation with reverse culture shock, where I'm like, oh my God, I'm not an American anymore, which is probably the most American thing you could ever say. But I really felt like I had a hard time understanding and being understood. I think I had a great need to be understood. Of course, that makes me think of that prayer. It's somewhere in the gospel, I think, but let me try to understand more than need to be understood. But anyway, we are where we are. And being able to bring back something with me from that outward journey, bringing back a new sense of identity. For one thing, I like to now think that a cosmopolitan identity in terms of a citizen of the cosmos. Cosmopolitan, this cosmos is the city, a citizen of the cosmos, that multiculturalism is possible. It is a real thing. And then there are some other major events in my own journey. You know, joining the Navy after returning from overseas, again confronted by this need to fit in. So what I had perceived as a failure to submit properly to guru so many years before that, I knew that a big impersonal institution like the military, well, that would just pound you over the head with submission. And it did and didn't. You know, I had to have so many struggles to try to individuate, to try to self-preserve and survive the system. And this fear of rejection came up that, well, I made this choice to join. Now I have to appear to be the same as everybody else, or I will be rejected. So this inner voice of don't be who you are really came up for me strongly. And it didn't last. Faking it didn't last. I was found out pretty quickly that I was not like the others. So to me, fake it until you make it is asat. It's just asat. That's all. It's ignorance. It's the opposite of what, it's the opposite of vulnerability. It's false identification, false bravado. No, I will pretend to be something more than I am until I'm accepted. And then then I'm found out, then I screw up. And so it doesn't sustain. And, you know, we only have so many more minutes, but I will just say kind of in general that on my journey, there's been thoughts of, you know, non-existence, that this life is just too hard. Maybe it's not worth it. And when those thoughts came up for me, there was so many factors that have played into me still being here today. You know, for one thing, it would simply crush my mother if I was to kill myself. You know, I say this because suicide is a problem, especially for men in our society. It just statistically, it's more common for men, but it is a problem for the whole society, men and women and everybody. So I hope that we can give it its proper time and attention in a future conversation. But for one thing, I couldn't do that to the people who loved me. And for another thing, I loved me. I couldn't do that to myself. You know, I still had, in spite of all the self-loathing, I still had this core belief that I was accepted. You know, my mother gave me unconditional love. My family nurtured me. That was the groundwork from which I was able to accept that God loves me. So maybe to draw the triangle, it's like self, others, God, or the whole. And you find your importance, your significance in the relationality. That's what saved me. Of course, I have my partner sitting right here, and she was there the whole time too. So it's very important to have someone that you can trust, at least one person that you can trust. So, you know, what brought me back to Gaudiya Vaishnavism? I mean, in a way, Bhakti Rasa, I never completely lost touch with you. I had some well-wishers, even when I was out in the woods, even when I was unsure, really doubted, at times felt a huge amount of resentment towards Guru, towards Krishna. Like, you ruined my life. I could have been a successful material, whatever, engineer, and never bothered with all this other stuff. What ended up bringing me back was simply acknowledging that there were well-wishers there in the background the whole time. Karnamrita Prabhu, rest in power and peace, and with your guru, he never gave up on me. He always kept in touch with me, and accepted, and never, and he, I remember specifically that at least five years ago or more, he was getting really personal online and doing shadow work and presenting that to the community and to the world, that he still had problems with his past and traumas and anartas and things he was working on. And he's a senior Vaishnava, at least in the sense of having been in part of the movement for so long. And So the signs were there that it is possible that being committed to something doesn't mean faking it. And then meeting Swami Padmanabha this in passing a few years ago, but then really diving in this year, these last 6 or 7 months, through the book Radical Personalism, there it is. Words were being put to thoughts and feelings that I had for a long time, and he was doing it so elegantly, without righteous anger, compassionately, that I knew I found something. I knew I found something I could hold on to. So I guess in closing, a little bit about my story and how that relates to, the path of bhakti. We talked about the quote from Srila Sridhar Maharaj, you and I, Bhakti Ras, a few days ago, that in the beginning we feel that everything is risk, and there's very little chance of any gain. If we think about, like, what's the term they use in economics? Risk benefit analysis, something like that. This is a common way of thinking. Even government decisions are based on a lot of time risk benefit analyses. In the beginning, everything looks like risk, and there's very little chance for benefit or gain. And then in the middle phase of our journey, if we've reached a middle phase, we've come to realize that the more we risk, the more vulnerable we're willing to be, the more empowerment can come and the more benefit can come, not just for ourselves, but for the whole. And if there is a final stage, which I don't know of personally, that potentially everything is benefit without risk. So, what does that mean for you? Where are you on your journey? How much is are these pillars of love, compassion, purity, honesty, how do they play a role in the way you conceive of yourself and your life? And and then hopefully, now having a language to understand our practices through those touchstones, nature, image, story, ritual, and counsel or satsang. So thank you guys so much. I have just a few minutes, maybe 5 minutes more for some conversation before I need to go. I'm going down to a local church to help decorate for the Christmas holidays, which I'm excited to do. So, yeah, please. I'm so blessed to have four people live with me on Zoom right now. So if anybody wants to bring something up, please, now's the time.
I'll just chime in and say thank you. It is Sunday, and I've had a really long week of energetic amazingness. So I am taking quiet time today. So that's why I'm usually the one who's talking all the time. So today I just wanted to sit and listen, and I really loved your share. It's heartfelt. And there's like, that was like five different talks in one time. In one talk, and it would be really nice to have you kind of break down just the ritual aspect and what it was like to be initiated, or just talk about satsang so that the group could, the questions would be easier to answer, because you're asking big questions, my friend.
Yes.
And I love that. I love that you're asking big questions. So keep doing what you're doing, and thank you everyone for sharing this space. And I'm just gonna go back to being quiet for the rest of the day. And it's
Thank
nice
you,
to meet you
Lakia.
guys. Yeah.
Yeah,
Namaste.
thanks for that.
Yeah,
I totally
namaste.
agree. I totally agree with her. There's like so many topics here that really need to be fleshed out more. I think we should
Yes.
go back over your talk, and then we'll continue conversations later on in time.
I had
So
at one
many
point I had
topics.
thought to give a kind of workshop on how to create rituals, because that was one of the things that I learned at the Illumine gathering, Awaken gathering. I participated in a workshop like that. So yes, I do want to touch on that. I love
it. I was thinking about that same thing, like a weekend workshop where people could learn how to create sadhana. So they have their sadhana. Because people always, I hear it in the ashram. I've heard it when I talk to people about, well, what do you do in your day, Lakia? Like, how does this start? And I'm like, well, I wake up and do these practices. And then I go to the studio and I do my sadhana. And they're like, what's that? Right? Like, so it would be good to bring to people what is your spiritual practice?
Maybe we can bring you into that future conversation. Lakia is pretty hardcore about waking up at 3:30 in the morning and doing her meditation. And yes, so I would love to hear more about your own as well. Yeah, Balaram Shakti, you have anything you want to say?
Yeah, thanks so much, Prabhu. I agree. There's so many threads being woven in there. If I wasn't driving through this whole time, I probably would have chimed in more earlier. But I want to share a few things. First of all, Richard Rohr, whom you drew heavily from, he talks about conversion. He says it's not that we have a message and then suffer for it. Rather, we suffer, come through it transformed, and then we have a message. So I just honor you and what you have suffered and transformed. That really came out as your message.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I thought it really nice. You brought up a beginner's mind as having that agnostic beginning, and you began your talk with Om Ajnana, which Sanskrit for agnostic.
Yes.
Begin, you know, not knowing, and it's the touch of the guru, right? That divine awakening of vision that we can see. And yeah, Richard Rohr says that only suffering and prayer are strong enough to decentralize the ego, right? And so that's the vulnerability that's needed to be transformed. And yeah, just to cut to the real essence that I'm seeing and hearing with your talk, you know, on loss and fear, you know, you pose that question to us, and my response was, you know, fear that I won't be able to sustain my identity, right? That this crisis will crush me, right? And what you're presenting with these five touchstones is we're connected to the divine, right? Call that whatever you want. And it's not like this idea that Richard Rohr definitely brings through very strongly, and Swami Padmanabha as well, that God is not static. He's not up there. It's not like there's a divine up there, but something dynamic.
Yes.
And seeing the way that these five touchstones really kind of blend into one another, right? You have nature, and then from nature there's an image, right? And that with that there's a story, and there's a ritual, that counsel that, you know, brings us into the sense of belonging in that. So it's like, how do we find ourselves in relation to that? How do we connect with that? And how, and in doing so, that gives us a sense of meaning, a sense of identity that is deep enough to overcome. And in closing here, I was kind of waiting for you to quote Richard Rohr. He says, what you don't mythologize, you pathologize. Right. So I think that's kind of like the takeaway.
Yes. Another way to say that, another way to say that would maybe be, what you don't universalize, you individualize, you know, if it doesn't become true, at least in theory for everybody, and it only affects me. It's only me. I'm the problem, or right. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. We're part of something greater, right? Yeah.
There's also another thing too, that says, when an inner situation is not made conscious, it appears in the world as an event. So it's the same, along the same lines. If we don't address the things that are within us, they present themselves externally.
You externalize it. You act it out, for sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, those are the right questions to ask, for sure. We do have to get off here. But thank you guys so much.
Thank you, John.
It's just really an
thank
honor.
You, Hugo.
Thank you, Bhakti Ras.
I look forward to seeing more comments and questions in the chat on YouTube. And if you feel inspired to, join in the conversation, please reach out to me or Bhakti Rasa. I'll make sure I can put my email address for people to see. So thank you guys so much, and to be continued.